Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the National Press Club and to this Lowy Institute event. I'm Sam Roggeveen. I'm a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute, and in a moment I'll introduce properly our special guest tonight, Jake Sullivan. A few preliminary comments from me before we start this this conversation about, well, US and world politics. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge three Lowy Institute board directors in our audience tonight: Penny Wensley, who will give the vote of thanks at the end, Joanna Hewitt, and Angus Houston. I'd also get in trouble if I didn't mention that my boss, Michael Fullilove, the executive director of the Lowy Institute, is in the audience tonight. I also want to quickly mention that the Lowy Institute's flagship product every year, the annual poll, is due out on Wednesday, so look out for that. Always interesting, fascinating results about Australians' views of the world and Australia's place in the world. And thirdly, I'd also like to acknowledge our sponsor for this event tonight and for our distinguished international fellowship program, and that's Telstra. So thank you very much to Telstra, and I believe we have some Telstra representatives in our audience tonight. So to business then, and I've now been involved with this distinguished international fellowship program, of which Jake is the latest. I've been involved with that since its inception four years ago. They're always it's a terrific program to bring out a distinguished policy professional who's also a thought leader out to Australia to learn a little bit about our foreign policy debate, but also make a big contribution to the foreign policy debate. And Jake has already done that in speeches in Sydney and in Melbourne, and you may have seen his article in the Financial Review on the weekend. I confess, Jake's program is about to wind up, but I confess I'm a little nervous about tomorrow and about the impression we leave him with, because I'm taking Jake to see Question Time in the House of Representatives. My job is to leave the best possible impression of our nation, and I feel like I'm letting the side down in that regard. Ladies and gentlemen, Jake Sullivan holds degrees from Yale and Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He worked on Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign before joining her at the State Department as her Deputy Chief of Staff and Director of Policy Planning. In 2012, Jake undertook secret negotiations with Iranian representatives on what became the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. And just to emphasise, Jake was 37 at that point, so it leaves the rest of us wondering what we've been doing with our lives. In President Obama's second term, Jake served as National Security Advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, who addressed the Lowy Institute last year. And more recently, Jake has returned to Yale Law School to teach. So that's a pretty stellar record. And in a moment, I'm going to open the floor to all of you, to all of your questions. So please start thinking of your questions now. Jake has breadth and depth, so you could ask about the campaign trail, you could ask about the negotiations with Iran, or anything in between. And I should also say, I'd really like to get questions from both genders tonight, so I'd love to see hands up, and I'm going to be alternating questions. So, Jake, let me make a start. And we're in the National Press Club tonight, so we should start by talking about the news. And the news overnight was that the United States shot down a Syrian jet in the Middle East. I wonder whether this represents some kind of escalation in your view in the Middle East, or is this something that doesn't necessarily indicate any specific change of policy for the U.S.?
Well, it's hard to talk about a change of policy when I think the administration doesn't actually really know what its policy in Syria is. And I don't say that glibly. They're struggling right now for understandable reasons, because on the one hand, I think they view Iran as the source of a huge amount of the instability and challenge in the Middle East. They want to give Iran a bloody nose. On the other, and they see Assad, obviously, as a client of Iran. On the other hand, they don't want to own Syria. They don't want to put a huge amount of American firepower at risk for something other than the fight against ISIS, that is to take on Assad or to more directly confront Iran. And they don't want to get crosswise with Russia. So how do you find a policy that on the one hand can push back aggressively against the Iranians, while on the other hand not put the United States in a position where they're going to have to escalate in Syria in a way that will offend Vladimir Putin or otherwise make them own a conflict they simply don't want to own? That's the challenge. And so the result has been a strategy of reaction in which there is no real affirmative effort to lay out the ground rules of what the United States will do or won't do, but rather to watch events unfold and then determine, based on what happens, what we're going to do in response. So that started with the strike, the chemical weapons strike by the Syrians that led to the American response with cruise missiles. And I think this, the most important factor in that strike was the fact that Barack Obama had not struck in 2013. So Donald Trump thought, I'll show you, I'm not Barack Obama, so I'm going to strike. I don't think that amounted to anything more than that or a larger strategy. Then came the incursion of Iranian-backed Shia proxy forces into areas that were controlled by Sunni fighters who the United States had helped train. And that led to a reaction, which was the bombing of those fighters. Then came the Syrian Air Force directly striking groups of those fighters, and that led to a reaction, which was the United States shooting down a Syrian fighter jet. You can see where this could go. It could go nowhere because the Syrians could draw back, or it could go to a dramatic escalation of the United States' involvement directly in Syria, unwittingly, without really meaning to do it. And that, in turn, could lead to a direct confrontation between the United States and Iran, which is something that I'm quite concerned about. Not a full-out war, but the kind of trading of blows that leads to miscalculations and mistakes on both sides, and then to an escalation that will leave the region less stable, our troops in the region more exposed, and will play into what I think is a problematic strategy of some of our Sunni partners in the region to whip things up rather than de-escalate things. So that's a long way of answering a short question, which was, does this amount to a change in policy or a change in strategy? I would say, no, it doesn't. It is the further carrying out of this policy of reaction. But a policy of reaction can very quickly have really problematic consequences for the U.S. and for the region.
And so any escalation then would be almost by accident, could we say that? I mean, President Trump, to the extent that he has any deeply held foreign policy beliefs, seems to believe that America has been overextended in the Middle East. And the America First doctrine suggests that President Trump's instincts going back to the 1980s have been that the United States has been taken for a ride and has been overextended and so on. So, and yet none of his advisors seem to share deeply that worldview. So could an escalation, if it happened, it seems to be that would happen almost by accident against Mr. Trump's deeply held beliefs.
I think this is where the tyranny of small decisions really comes into play. So Trump does not want to own Syria or fight in Syria. That is a deeply held view. Trump also wants to defeat, crush, use your verb that is the maximalist verb for whatever we should do to ISIS, obliterate, destroy, demolish, bigly, hugely crush ISIS. Trump wants to do that. So now here's the tyranny of small decisions. How do you beat ISIS? Well, American firepower is part of it, but so is the training and equipping of American-backed fighters on the ground, including both Kurds and Sunnis. Okay, so now they're running around in Syria, and if the Iranians or the Syrians go after them, well, then another American instinct kicks in, which is best summed up in the Toby Keith country song. Some of you may have heard it. Includes a line, "We'll put a boot up your ass," is sort of Kissingerian in its strategic distillation, that the United States is going to punch back hard if our guys get hit. And in this case, our guys, because you got Mattis and McMaster in senior positions in the U.S. government, include the people that DOD and other parts of the U.S. government are training. So that's how you end up heading down this road without really wanting to. And because Syria is such a mess, and there are so many different constellations of fighters arrayed against one another in different parts of the country, the possibilities here for this to spin out of control are not small. Even all the while, Donald Trump is waking up in the morning and going to bed at night saying, I don't really want to get too involved in Syria. And then there's one more dimension to all of this, which is the degree to which he is prepared to delegate, some might say outsource, some of the core military deployment decision-making to his Secretary of Defense and to his generals. He's done that full scale in Afghanistan, where he's basically said it's up to them to decide how many more troops they want to stick in Afghanistan, which is kind of an astonishing step for a president to take. And I would guess that in Syria and Iraq, he's essentially going to defer on the question of what kind of firepower and what kind of manpower the United States needs to amass to go after ISIS. And then each of these decisions, which should be put in a larger strategic context, become battlefield tactical decisions. Shooting down a Syrian aircraft should be a fundamental core presidential call tied to a larger strategy. Instead, I think it really is, well, this just happened out there, so now we got to think about what we're going to do to it right now. So I think that is the mix of factors at play here, which is why you can't use a kind of general inclination not to get involved as a good guide for how American policy is going to play out in the Middle East right now.
I know, Michael Fulilov, in relation to U.S. policy in the Middle East, and particularly with the Obama administration, Michael is fond of quoting a line from The Godfather 3, which is the only memorable line from that sequel, which is Michael Corleone, who's trying to get out of the family business, saying, "Every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in." Is this another administration that's going to be pulled back into the Middle East? And what does that say about this region and about whether this region will get any sustained attention from the United States under President Trump?
Well, I do worry about this very much. I think it is fair to say that the early indicators are that the United States is going to get more deeply enmeshed in the Middle East over the course of the next year rather than pull back. And while we can walk and chew gum at the same time, there are trade-offs. There are strategic trade-offs when you put that level of effort and initiative into one region. It does come at a cost in other regions, and I worry that it will come at the cost of the type of elevated engagement we need here in the Asia-Pacific. And a good indicator of this was Trump's trip to the region. When he comes to Asia in the fall, I hope there is an even larger glowing orb present, because that may attract some more attention this way. But when he showed up in Riyadh, he essentially bought in to the narrative of the Gulf states, which said the United States needs to do more here. They need to put more troops here. They need to put more firepower here. They need to provide more intelligence support for us in our fight against the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And I think the net result of that trip was essentially the United States posturing that we are going to increase the tempo and scope of our engagement in the Middle East. And at some level, resources are finite, attention is finite, and particularly when we haven't staffed up the administration. So you don't even have an Assistant Secretary of State or an Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Asia Pacific. It's hard to see how this doesn't come at some cost to this part of the world.
I want to pivot over to the United States now and ask you just a couple of questions on that, and then I'll open things up. Although it's hard to think of two figures who are personally more different than Obama and Trump, there is some continuity there in terms of their beliefs, a sense that the era of America pulling back slightly from its global role, that started under Obama and is now that Trump is a continuation of that trend. The key question for me, I think, is whether that is cyclical. Is that just something that happens after America loses big wars, for instance, in Iraq, and as it did in Vietnam as well? Or is this a permanent condition of the changing conditions in the globe and perhaps even the rise of other great powers?
So one thing that I learned over the last couple of years is making big predictions like that are very, very difficult. And so I will have the humility not to give a definitive answer to that question. Well, I'll just make a couple of observations. The first is, I think you're right about President Obama and President Trump. These two people could not be more different in so many fundamental ways. And yet they arrive at similar conclusions in at least three respects on foreign policy. The first, which President Obama made no bones about, is a kind of sense that the foreign policy establishment of the United States has led our policy astray over the last 15 years. And by the way, he's not just talking about the Bush administration. He's sort of talking generally about the guardians, the cardinals of American foreign policy. His chief advisor, Ben Rhodes, called it the blob. That's a term Donald Trump could easily abuse to describe the foreign policy establishment. Second is, Obama had a sense that our allies were free riders too. Now, I don't think he would have pinned that label on a country like Australia, but he sent Bob Gates around Europe, browbeating our NATO partners years before Donald Trump did it. And he once famously said that if the UK didn't step up in terms of its own defense investments and commitments, it would put the special relationship at risk. So those are very reflective of or redolent of what Donald Trump could have said. And then the third is that Obama was very fond of saying, we have to be focused on nation building at home when pressed on what we should be doing in Afghanistan and other parts of the world. That could have been Donald Trump's second tagline right below America First. So each in their own way, these guys understood something about where the American people are and where what this moment is after two wars that the American people believe have cost us much and gained us little, and after a financial crisis that the American people see as having an exposed an economy that's not working for them. I believe that the answer will be this is a permanent condition unless those of us who care about muscular American engagement in the world recognize this fact about where the American psyche is right now, and not just adapt our rhetoric, our sales pitch, but actually take account of the fact that we need to do a better job, for example, of connecting foreign economic policy to national security, that we need to think more carefully about under what circumstances we intervene in other countries, that we have to do a better job of connecting means and ends. The United States gets in trouble when we set out these sweeping goals like Assad must go and then don't have the ends to actually back it up. That undermines credibility abroad, but it also makes the American people say, hey, what's this all about? So we have our work cut out for us, but I fundamentally believe that ultimately the American people are not isolationists, despite the kind of common view that we toggle between isolationism and interventionism. I think there is a fundamental view in the United States that our fortune and our future is connected to the rest of the world. And while Donald Trump has hijacked the debate to a certain extent right now, the vital center in the United States is still committed to internationalism. We just have to be able to reconnect for them what a kind of principled policy in the national interest, how it connects to the kind of internationalist tendencies that reflect America at its best in the world. And I think we can do that, but it's going to take political leadership.
Well, what you've just heard there in that answer was a distillation, I think, of the speech that Jake gave in Melbourne last Thursday, and I'd recommend that speech to all. You can find it on our website. Final question from me, Jake. We've read lots over the last few months about Russian efforts to meddle in the US election and the US electoral process. What do you make of the reports? Where are we on this now? And ultimately, is President Trump's leadership at stake here? And could we be talking about impeachment?
You know, it's interesting. There's this expression in America that sort of came out of Watergate that it's never the crime, it's the cover-up. And now we're trending into territory where it's neither the crime nor the cover-up, but potentially the cover-up of the cover-up. That's kind of how crazy this whole situation is getting, what with the looming threat of possibly firing or clipping the wings of Bob Mueller, who's investigating Trump for obstruction of justice, of an investigation into his campaign associates' connections to Russia. So it's a tangled web for sure. And every time you think that the lawyers or the spinmeisters have sort of gotten Donald Trump off of Twitter or away from news cameras on this issue, he comes back with another salvo, as he just did in the last 24 hours. So on the facts as we know them today, I don't believe that a Republican-controlled House and a Republican-controlled Senate is likely to impeach Donald Trump. And even if Bob Mueller finds that there is grounds for obstruction of justice, which I think would be a completely credible finding based on what we know, under our Constitution, there's real doubt about whether a sitting U.S. president can actually be criminally prosecuted. So if the courts are not available and Congress is blocked, then it kind of comes down to how Donald Trump manages through all this pressure. And since he has been the epitome of grace under pressure so far on this, I think we can expect smooth sailing. No, it's very possible that he continues to compound the damage and in fact puts himself in a situation that he would not otherwise have been in but for his own choices and decisions. And, you know, anytime I talk to my Republican friends about this, I ask them to just consider the following thought experiment. Imagine if Barack Obama had fired Jim Comey because he didn't like the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, and then went on NBC News the next day and said to Lester Holt, yeah, I didn't think there was anything to this email thing, and I didn't like the way that Jim Comey was showboating about it, so I fired him. How fast would the Republicans be drawing up articles of impeachment in that circumstance? Pretty fast. That is a direct parallel to what happened in this case here. But politics being what they are, I think this will hurt Trump. I think it will slow certain aspects of his agenda. But I don't fundamentally believe that it represents a mortal threat to his presidency unless he keeps piling on top of it. And, you know, you could make a good bet that he will do some more self-defeating things along the way, and we'll just have to see how acute they are.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to raise your hands for a question, I would ask you to confine yourself to questions rather than statements. And we'll start at the back.
Hi, Albert Palazzo. In this morning's Los Angeles Times, there was a op-ed by Andrew Bacevich in which he said that Donald Trump was pushing responsibilities onto the generals because he didn't see any upside for him in any of these wars, and that Mattis would eventually be the fall guy. Do you believe that President Trump has the attributes necessary for a successful war leader? After all, he's inherited three wars.
So I spent 2 years on the campaign trail. I'm from Minnesota, which is a polite Midwestern place, mostly populated by Scandinavian Lutherans. I'm an Irish Catholic, so but I tried to pretend as best I could to get along. So I try to be very polite, but couldn't help myself on the campaign trail but to repeatedly and consistently call Donald Trump temperamentally unfit to be commander-in-chief. I believed that on the campaign trail. Obviously, that argument did not succeed in persuading enough people. I still believe that today. And I think that I haven't seen Andrew Bacevich's op-ed, but I was making a similar point in a meeting earlier today with the foreign minister when we were talking about this. My view is that the way Trump looks at a decision like how to add more troops to Afghanistan is strictly through the lens of what about where? How do I get out of this looking the best? And here's his problem. He spent 2 years basically telling his base who wants out of Afghanistan as fast as possible. Because as far as they're concerned, Kabul and Kandahar and Herat are, you know, they can burn. They do not want to be responsible for this. He doesn't want to be looking them in the eye and say, you know what I did? I ordered 4,000 more American troops, a 50% increase in what we've got on the ground there right now. And so, you know, forget everything I said before. On the same line, he doesn't want to be in a position where ISIS commits an attack inspired by some cell in eastern Afghanistan. So what's his solution? To do the unprecedented thing of basically saying, I will simply allow the Secretary of Defense to decide whether we're going to add a substantial number of troops to a theater in which we're engaged in a war. That is a remarkable abdication of responsibility, but I think it's on a kind of a strictly linear and analytical kind of political assessment is totally understandable. And I think you can expect to see more of this kind of thing when it comes to military deployments in the Middle East and the possible use of military force in the Middle East.
Thanks very much, Jake. Look, a very short question just to do with Saudi Arabia. I wonder if you could say something about Trump's motivation in visiting Saudi Arabia, the country that has, of course, contributed the largest number of foreign fighters for the ISIS cause.
You know, it's really interesting because on the campaign, Trump used Saudi Arabia as a boogeyman, sort of said, Hillary Clinton, she's in bed with the Saudis, they gave all kinds of money, these are bad people, and so forth. So in a way, his views on this during the campaign seemed to line up much more with those who sort of advocated for a changed relationship with Saudi Arabia, or an adjusted one in some way. So then he comes into office, and I think three things happen. Number one, Mohammed bin Salman, the deputy crown prince of Saudi Arabia, shows up early on in the White House and says, I am prepared to invest tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in job creation in the United States. Okay, Trump thinks that's pretty good. So that's point one. Point two, his entire coterie of advisors is united on at least one point, which is Iran is the enemy. And if Iran is the enemy, well, then who's the vanguard of the anti-Iran coalition? It's Saudi Arabia. So now they're Saudi. Number three, he has a natural affinity, which has been borne out in case after case, for strong men, strong leaders. He, in my view, sees small d Democrats, democratically elected leaders, as basically the same thing as big D Democrats, like American liberal Democrats who whine at him about things like climate change and human rights and stuff he doesn't want to hear about. And by the way, don't come promise him hundreds of billions of dollars of investment that their family can mobilize in job creation in the United States. So when you put those together, he likes strong men, strong leaders. It has a deeply anti-Iran bent, and he sees Saudi as useful to his domestic agenda. You get him throwing in with the Saudis, and then once he's there, it's like, might as well go all in, you know, might as well put your hand on the orb and do it. And now he's all in. And I worry, you know, I think we need to have a constructive partnership with Saudi Arabia, but I do think we have to be much more direct and honest with them about their financing of terrorism. And I worry that just buying in wholesale to their agenda in the Middle East is not necessarily going to serve the American interest all that well, but that's basically what we've done.
Some Democratic leaders come whining to him about refugee deals from the Obama administration as well.
Right, exactly.
Thanks very much, Sheikh. I was just wondering, with the event this week with the Syrian plane and the Trump administration showing that they're very reactive in terms of their foreign policy rather than having a long-term nuanced strategy in place, I was just wondering your thoughts on how this plays out in the context of North Korea.
So the big challenging question for any American president, and this is one where I feel for Trump and for his team, because it's a vexing question. Can we end up in a circumstance where we're not either using military action with all of the unthinkable consequences that attend it, or where we're not acquiescing in North Korea developing an ICBM capability? And by the way, this isn't just about, when I speak about the ICBM capability, it's not just that, you know, the United States only cares if the missiles can hit us. That's all we're interested in. Who cares if they already have missiles that can hit Japan and Korea and so forth? That isn't the right logic. The reason why stopping North Korea from getting an ICBM is so important is the same reason why Kim Jong-un is hell-bent on getting it, which is he wants to be able to say to the South Koreans, America's extended deterrence, their nuclear umbrella for you, isn't worth a darn because we can hold them at risk, so you can't count on them to come to your defense. Now, we would never allow that to happen under any circumstances, but that begins to have a kind of destabilizing effect. So this is the stakes here, in my view, are very real, and the administration is right to be trying to find a way to stop North Korea's march towards getting this capability. I think they have concluded that the preemptive military option is an unattractive option that they do not want to use. And General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, has been working overtime to assert that, not just privately, but to put it out publicly in a way to try and shape the conversation. So they're left pushing China. I was saying earlier today to some other people that a typical meeting in the White House Situation Room on China usually involves somebody saying, you know, everyone agrees from every intelligence service out there that the North Koreans aren't going to give this up easily, and the Chinese are limited in what they can do. And then the next 2 hours, the only agenda item is, what can we get the Chinese to do to make the North Koreans give up their nuclear weapons? And that there's this kind of disconnect between what everybody out, all the experts out there seem to say, and what we keep trying to do in terms of our policy. But I think the Trump administration is not wrong to try their best to put a lid on the North Korean capability by any possible diplomatic means. So if we can get to the table and halt them from making further progress, we should do so. But whether any of that is possible or not, I think, is very much an open question. And the U.S. is currently struggling to figure out how they can find a way to stop North Korea from getting across this final line. And this is one of those things where, as much as I'm going to come in and criticize the administration for the kinds of things it's doing in the Middle East and elsewhere, on this one, they're faced with a range of very bad options. And I don't think that the way they've played their hand so far is particularly objectionable. I think they're casting about, just like we would have done if we had won, for a potential solution to a wicked problem.
Hi, Jake. I think, you know, Jim Clapper's also here in Canberra, and he spoke, I think, last week or the week before here at the press club as well, and he said the Australian-US alliance is a lot stronger than a transient incumbent in the White House. What's your perspective on the Australian-US relationship and how it will go through the Trump administration?
So I'm going to put in a shameless plug for the Lowy Institute poll, which is coming out soon, right? In 2007, at the height of the Iraq surge, after years of Iraq war fatigue, if you look at the numbers in the U.S.-Australia alliance, they sort of hit their low point. Okay, so that was a decade ago. Lower, by the way, than they are even today under Trump. And it bounced back pretty vigorously and robustly with a change of administration, a change of leadership, and I would argue some important changes in personnel at other levels too, including this woman they made Secretary of State and other things along those lines. And so I actually believe that the underlying foundation of the relationship is quite strong. And that naturally, who is president and what kind of policy they're pursuing and how they reflect on the United States has an impact on public opinion in any given year. But the basic ballast that keeps this relationship from tipping over is still very much there. Now, that doesn't mean we can take it for granted. If, for example, we were looking at 8 years of drift and neglect in the region or worse, I think undoing that damage would take longer than just a new election and someone else walking in, and there'd have to be quite a bit of repair work. But I do believe that even some amount of deterioration in the U.S. position in the Asia Pacific, because we're not paying attention or because we're not making the investments we have to over the next 3 years, and a lack of attention and care and feeding for the alliance over the next 3 years, that to me is recoverable, because I think this relationship is incredibly strong and robust and will continue even now at working levels and above. In fact, Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson were just here for what by all accounts was a pretty effective Osman meeting, where the two sides saw a pretty common strategic picture and made tangible progress on some issues. I'm a short-term pessimist on this relationship and on U.S. policy towards the Asia Pacific, but I'm a long-term optimist because I think so many of the fundamentals are just pointing in the right direction.
But Jake, it's not just about America and what America does or any specific administration does. It's also about China, isn't it? And about the rise of China and what that means for Australia's place in the region between these two great powers. What have you observed in Australia over the last week and a bit about our China debate? I know you've been following some of the investigations that have occurred in the media, in the Fairfax Press recently.
So one of the things that has surprised me is the degree to which many in the strategic community in Australia, the people that, you know, I've been talking to about this, have a kind of sense of inevitability about where China is headed. When I think that the word that best defines China's future is uncertainty, that there are many uncertain factors, both domestically and in terms of its relationships in the region. Now, is it fair to say that China is going to be a large dynamic actor in this region? Absolutely. But where it heads on its economy, on its politics, and in how it relates to other countries in the region and the degree to which they resist it being pushed around by China. All of that will say a lot about what exactly the nature of its influence and impact on the region is. So for me, most of this is a much more open question, and we collectively, as democratic allies, as countries that care deeply about a rules-based order in the Asia-Pacific, as countries that resist any concept of a 19th-century-style sphere of influence, have a lot to say about how this all turns out. And to the extent that the United States is not at the steering wheel at the moment on that big question, I think the answer isn't more acquiescence and more kind of throwing up of hands. It should be countries like Australia and Japan and others stepping up to do their part to push forward this notion of a rules-based order. I felt that the Prime Minister's speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue was a great contribution for that very reason, to enunciate a set of principles without being confrontational, without pushing a line of containment or competition, but rather to simply say, we have a vision for where the future of this region goes. That vision includes a strong, thriving, prosperous China, but it doesn't include intimidation, coercion, or the attempt to dominate by any one power in this region. So I guess my answer on the China question fundamentally is, this is not a matter of capacity. It's not like collectively we all have no power to do anything about this. It's a matter of will and judgment and taking the right approach so that we reach an outcome that is fundamentally in China's interest, in the region's interest, and in America's interest. I think we can do that. The last thing I would say on this is, one of the things that has always worried me about Donald Trump's worldview, to the extent he has a consistent worldview, is that he sees the world in zero-sum terms. If someone else is doing well, it means we're somehow losing, or we're chumps, or they've taken something from us. And that, to me, is antithetical to the foundation of American foreign policy over the last 70 years, where we believe that we do well when others do well. And that goes for China. I mean, the United States spent decades investing heavily in the security and stability of the Asia Pacific to create the conditions by which China could have this remarkable rise. We don't view that rise as the failure of U.S. policy. We view that rise as the success of decades of enlightened American policy in the region. Now, it was combined with an absolute commitment to being present and engaged as a resident power in the Asia Pacific, which is an important ingredient of it, and I hope that that will continue.
We have a question in the front row.
Jake, I'm Angus Houston, and I just would like to take that a little bit further. If we have a look at the South China Sea at the moment, three islands, fully militarized, and that program of reclamation and militarization is almost complete. How do you think Trump's going to handle that? I know USS Dewey did a freedom of navigation operation a few weeks ago, but that's been the only test in the South China Sea. And given the latest developments in the Philippines, I'd also be interested in your views, given what you've already said about big hammers being used to solve problems with Islamic State, how the Trump administration might deal with the current problem on Mindanao in the Philippines.
Thanks. You've gotten to the heart of my worry about the current administration's policy towards the Asia Pacific, which is, I believe right now that Trump's Asia policy is a North Korea policy, and that the basic bargain he's made with Xi Jinping coming out of Mar-a-Lago is, we'll keep working with you to try to deal with North Korea, and in exchange, we're not getting in a trade war, and we're not really going to push it too hard on the South China Sea. I don't think he said that, but I think we have signaled that in spades, starting with the fact that it took months for that freedom of navigation operation, that it is the exception that proves the rule to American silence on matters in the South China Sea. And I basically think Xi Jinping is sitting there right now saying, this is a pretty good deal, much better than we could have expected when he won, or after he won when he put the One China policy up for debate on Taiwan. And I think that Xi Jinping knew what he was doing when he showed up in Mar-a-Lago, that He had an approach that was well-crafted to play to all of Donald Trump's foibles, and that he recognized that Trump's basic transactionalism could be taken advantage of by a much more sophisticated, multifaceted Chinese policy. And that is what I believe we are watching play out. And as a result, I think China's advances in the South China Sea continue. And I think that that will come at a cost to core principles that matter for regional stability going forward. I've heard from some people I respect enormously here in Australia that they sort of seen the South China Sea issue almost now as a lost cause, that we've come so far that it's kind of gone. I don't see it that way for two reasons. First, you have to look at the militarization of the islands from the perspective of the degree to which we can hold them at risk in kind of the overall strategic stability in the region. And I believe that U.S. naval doctrine, military doctrine is such that these are not game changers from the perspective of China's capacity to push the United States out of the region. So there's that. Then the second issue is really the core one, which is, will we permit any country to declare open waterways that carry huge amounts of trade and commerce sort of their territory, their dominion that they may deign to grant access to others, but it's not others' right to access them? And that is still a very open question from my perspective. It will require an active and engaged effort on the part of the United States and all of our allies to make sure that we are reinforcing that. I thought what the Prime Minister said at Shangri-La on this exact point was really important. But no, so I think the South China Sea remains an issue that we should not have an air of resignation about. On the Philippines, Trump has already said that he will provide more special operations support to the, as you've read, to the operation in Mindanao. And I believe that in a sense, as long as it's a train, advise, assist kind of mission, is a bit of a bottomless well if Duterte decides he needs to call on more help there. What I would hope as we head towards this summit in Manila later this year that Trump has said he's going to go to is that the United States would think about that effort against ISIS in the larger context of our strategic relationship with the Philippines, sort of say, let's talk about every aspect, including our naval arrangements, including your posture on the South China Sea, et cetera. I don't think that that is likely because from Trump's perspective, the ISIS issue is so far surpassing in his mind of importance these other things that he doesn't fully grasp, that I think this is going to be pretty much just what do we have to do to deal with these militants who are now wrapping themselves in the ISIS flag if before they were wrapping themselves in the Abu Sayyaf flag. I think tactically it will be fine, but I don't think strategically he's going to seize any opportunity out of it.
Thanks so much for the presentation tonight. It's been fantastic. I'd love to hear you talk about Iran, though, and specifically the JCPOA. I think Trump once referred to it as the worst deal in the history of deals, and I know that his election seemed to embolden the hardliners in Iran, but not enough to kind of tip the recent election there. So I'm just really fascinated to hear kind of your reflections on Iran and I guess the future of the deal under Trump.
Yeah, so I took exception when Trump said it was the worst deal in the history of humankind. I think it's at least the third or fourth worst deal. I mean, definitely not the worst, right? No. It was funny. When that happened, my mom actually called me and was like, I don't know a whole lot about nuclear stuff, but like, is he right? Were you working on the worst deal ever in history? And I was like, yeah, okay, thanks for the vote of confidence. Now, he also said he'd rip it up on day one, which he hasn't done. Why? Because he's come to recognize, as I think the Israeli security establishment came to recognize, and frankly, quietly, as many of the Sunni states did as well, that we had reached a point of such instability that it really was a choice between cutting a deal and military action. That if you remove this deal, Iran's capabilities are such that they could very quickly reduce their breakout time to one weapon's worth of weapons-grade uranium to a matter of weeks, which at that point means the nuclear clock is ticking very fast, and the sanctions clock doesn't tick that fast, leaving only really the military option. So I think Trump has looked at that and said, okay, I don't want to end up in that, faced with that choice. Therefore, I'm going to hold my nose and certify, A, Iran is complying with the deal, and B, that we will continue to waive sanctions and keep the deal going. I think he hates doing it, so he's accompanying it with all kinds of rhetoric, and I think it has an impact on decisions elsewhere in the region. But I don't believe he's going to stop doing that because he does not want to see the United States as blamed for ripping up the deal and walking away. So what then? I think the deal is still in peril because first, in order to compensate for this seeming weakness of continuing a deal he said he was going to rip up, I think he's going to be looking elsewhere to be tough on Iran and push back against Iran. And that gets right into the challenge I was talking about before about a potential confrontation, which in turn could easily lead to one or both sides walking away from the deal. Second, these deals are unbelievably complicated in their execution. We're talking about dozens of pages of annexes about the amount of heavy water that can be kept, the amount of low enriched uranium, the amount of material in the piping, etc. It is almost impossible not to have some form of violation of the deal. And if the Trump administration goes around looking for that, they could find it. And so a second possibility would be kind of death by a thousand cuts, where they find a bunch of these small violations and then decide to declare that Iran has been in breach and walk away. And I think the third possibility is that the United States says, okay, we agreed to lift sanctions on the nuclear program, but we didn't agree to lift sanctions on other things, ballistic missiles, support for terrorism, human rights. So we're going to reimpose all the sanctions we lifted on the nuclear thing under these other names, saying, oh, that's consistent with the deal, which could lead the Iranians to walk away. And calibrating how much they can pile new sanctions on is not an easy thing. And so for all of those reasons, I think the deal remains fragile and at risk. At the same time, I have long believed that the United States has more wherewithal to put pressure on Iran without having to worry that Iran's going to walk away from the deal tomorrow. Iran needs this deal, and that was reinforced repeatedly through the course of the election campaign, and Rouhani's resounding victory showed the strength of support for this deal in Iran. So I don't think we should be walking on eggshells when it comes to pushing back on Iran's destabilizing activities in the region, but I think we should be mindful of the degree to which this deal remains somewhat tenuous and precarious, and that losing it would be profoundly not in the interest of either the United States or our partners in the region.
Jake, regarding the worst deal in history, I think as long as history remembers the Nazi-Soviet pact, you're probably safe. Do we have time for one final question? This gentleman, the third row.
Thank you, John Murray. Do you believe that ISIS poses a bigger threat than North Korea to the policies of the United States, or is a concentration of forces in the Middle East due more to the absence of an equivalent of Israel in Northern Asia?
I don't actually believe that what is motivating our fight against ISIS is the state of Israel. I think it is very much about the connection between safe havens for plotting and inspiring to terrorist attacks in the United States and in our partner countries, including Australia, but also in Europe. So I don't think that the Israel issue factors decisively into our decision to deploy forces in Iraq and Syria in 2017. I believe that ISIS is a serious threat that needs to be confronted vigorously, including militarily, but if we only are doing it militarily, then we are never going to succeed, because what's going to happen is we will take back Raqqa and we will take back Mosul, and all of those fighters will scatter into the desert, and we will end up with the son of ISIS or the cousin of ISIS, because there are 20 million Sunnis living between Shia-dominated capitals in Baghdad and Damascus, and that strategic fact is not going away even if we achieve military victory. We saw that once before in 2011, and we'll see it again if we don't have a broader strategy. ISIS only becomes an existential threat to the United States if one of two things happen. Either we just let them run completely roughshod, and I think we have now placed immense military pressure on them, so I don't worry so much about that. Or we let them win at home by fundamentally undermining democratic values in ways that remake our societies. And that is, through intolerance, through increased national security state powers that go beyond what is the appropriate balance between liberty and security. And we need to resist that. And part of what I worry about with Donald Trump is that he has managed to blur and blend fear of the other between immigrants and ISIS and walls and bans and refugees, so that he's kind of mushed it all up into one thing. And I do think that represents a real threat to who we are as a country. And so that's not about a guy sitting in Raqqa right now plotting. It's about the knock-on effects of the fear factor and how it remakes the way that we think about ourselves, our society, our diversity, our openness. And I do really worry about that. That, to me, is not a present threat with respect to the North Korea issue. Now, North Korea, the idea that they could at some point miniaturize a nuclear device and place it on top of an ICBM that could reach the United States, that is a profound national security threat. But is a national security threat of an entirely different character from the type of threat that I think ISIS is posing to us right now, only partly through ISIS's doing, and then partly through the compounding effects of the reaction that we've seen. So it's not a direct answer to your question, but those are my thoughts on how to assess this threat landscape in the complicated world we're in now.
Ladies and gentlemen, for that wonderful hour of discussion, would you please now join me in thanking Jake Sullivan? I'd now like to introduce very briefly Penny Wensley, former Queensland Governor, a distinguished diplomat, and a Lowy Institute Board Director, for the vote of thanks. Penny Wensley.
Thank you. I'm right here. Thanks very much, Sam. Well, actually, I have one announcement and a triple vote of thanks. So the announcement, first of all, is that I want to let you know that the Institute is very keen to ensure that it expands its activities here in Canberra, and it's clear from tonight's audience that there is a strong appetite for that to happen. We have now three board members, all Canberra-based, myself, Angus Houston, and Joanna Hewitt, and of course we have Sam Roggeveen, who is our Distinguished Senior Fellow, and he's also Canberra-based, and he said if you have any questions, by all means, contact him. But we look forward, Michael, to many more activities here in Canberra. We can't all go to Sydney and Melbourne for the things that you do, and we're delighted that we had the opportunity to hear this wonderful presentation tonight. My triple thanks, first of all, Sam, thank you very much for conducting this conversation. Secondly, Telstra, thank you very much indeed for continuing to sponsor this distinguished international program. It's a really wonderful program. It's going from strength to strength, as you've seen tonight, and we are profoundly grateful to Telstra for supporting it. And then finally, of course, to thank Jake for a fantastic presentation. Jake, you made a couple of remarks about your Minnesota origins. I had a little fun today looking up some of the things about Minnesota. One of them is that the state anthem is called Hail Minnesota. The state motto is L'Etoile du Nord, the Star of the North. I also looked up the meaning of Minnesota, and it is variously, it's a Dakota Sioux word, variously meaning cloudy water or sky water. And then putting all of that together, I thought to myself tonight, well, first of all, we have had someone here who has traveled from America to try to help us deal with some of the cloudy water of foreign policy and international relations. And I must say that I think you have given, for some of us, a degree of reassurance that there are ways forward. Personally, I was very encouraged to hear you say that the vital center of the United States is still committed to an international role, a robust, muscular international role, and for internationalists such as there are many in this audience, that is reassuring to hear, although it'll be very interesting to see how the voices actually manage to cut through the present noise. Secondly, as far as L'Étoile du Nord is concerned, it's very obvious, I think, to everyone here tonight that we have indeed a star in our midst, a commentator on foreign policy, perceptive, incisive, candid, sharing an enormous amount of experience with us all. And so I would ask all of you to join me, not only in Hail Minnesota, but hail Jake Sullivan.